favorite band play live. He's thought about it all week. He bought his ticket. He wore his band t-shirt. He went to the concert venue. He wasn't allowed inside the concert venue. He put away his band t-shirt. He threw away his ticket. And he thought about it all week.
Don't wait until it hits you. Get vaccinated. Beginning in September, you'll need a vaccination passport to enter certain public spaces. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Boutu. Following the Israeli elections, 120 members of Knesset sworn into the Israeli Knesset. Among them are a number of new MKs from the relatively new Otzma Yehudit, the Jewish Power Party. The Jewish Power Party is a far-right Israeli political party that was founded in 2012, whose members are followers of Rabbi Meir Kahane. In order to understand the Jewish Power Party, it's first necessary to understand who Rabbi Meir Kahane is and to understand his vision. Rabbi Meir Kahane was born in Brooklyn in 1932. He founded the Kach Party, which called for the establishment of a theocratic Jewish state encompassing not just all of current Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, in other words, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, but also large parts of neighboring Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. Kahane believed in the strict separation of Jews and non-Jews, and for the enslavement or expulsion of indigenous Palestinians. While he was in the Knesset in the 1980s, he introduced a set of laws which read in part, one, non-Jews will be obliged to assume duties, taxes, and slavery. If he does not agree to slavery and taxes, he will be forcibly deported. Two, a non-Jew will not live within the jurisdiction of the city of Jerusalem. Three, a non-Jew who has a marital relationship with a Jew is liable to 50 years in prison. A Jewish prostitute or Jewish male who has an affair with a non-Jewish male is sentenced to 5 years in prison. These are just some of the ideas that he espoused. Now, it's believed that Kahane's followers murdered dozens of people and injured hundreds of others in numerous violent attacks against Palestinians, against Americans, and others in Israel and in the occupied territories. As a result, the Kach Party and the Jewish Defense League and its offshoots were labeled as terrorist organizations by the U.S. government. Kahane himself was arrested about 70 times in the U.S. and in Israel for planning and carrying out violent attacks, but he never received any serious crimes for his punishment. During Kahane's lifetime, his movement was considered to be marginal in Israeli society, and some people would say that it was shunned in Israeli politics. However, three decades after his assassination in New York, he remains an inspiration for Jewish extremists, and his racist ideas have become much more mainstream and much more popular in Israel than ever before. During the 2019 and 2021 election campaigns, Israel's longest serving prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and his Likud party even entered into political agreements with Kahane's followers in order to help them get elected into the Knesset, into the parliament. So this week, it is members of that Jewish power party, this offshoot of the Kach party, these descendants of these followers of Rabbi Meir Kahane, who will be sworn into power. Now, the Jewish Power Party has been described as a, quote, legal rendition, unquote, of the Kach Party. But like the Kach Party, it is racist, it espouses Jewish supremacy, and the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. Its platform calls for establishing a national authority for encouraging emigration of Palestinians. And while some of their members were banned by the Israeli Supreme Court for running for Knesset because of their long history of extreme racism and inciting hatred and violence against Palestinians, one person who will be sworn in this week is Itamar Ben-Gvir, who has openly declared that Baruch Goldstein, the man who massacred 29 Palestinians in Hebron in February 1994, he's declared that Baruch Goldstein is his hero. In fact, he dressed up as Baruch Goldstein one year for Purim. In this episode, we will hear about the Kahanist movement and its impact on Israeli politics.
David Sheen is an investigative journalist who has written a number of pieces on the Kahanist movement, including on the murder of Alex Arutí. So let me step back. So who is, for those who don't know, who was Meir Kahane, mm-hmm. and what did he want? What was his ideology?
Mm-hmm. Meir Kahane was an American-born Jewish rabbi who immigrated to Israel, became a lawmaker, a member of Israel's Knesset. And there's so much to unpack, but in the shortest version of it was that his ideology and what set him apart from other secular Zionists and from religious Zionists in Israel, what set him apart, he was even, you know, so far past the farthest right parties in Israel. He wasn't just that he, like the most extreme settlers, wanted to, you know, be vigilantes, you know, and encroach upon Palestinian land, you know, be the vanguard of the, you know, Zionist colonist movement. But in addition to this, they didn't just, like the regular settlers, believe that, oh, we have no choice but to be violent with these Palestinians, with these non-Jews in our midst. Because what to do, you know, this has been, you know, forced upon us by the situation. So unfortunately, we have no choice but to, you know, take a heavy hand with them. No, the Kahanists distinguished themselves from the rest of the far-right settlement movement by saying, no, it's actually a mitzvah, it's actually a good deed, it's actually a blessing, it's actually a sacrament to kill Palestinians, to kill Arabs, to kill non-Jews that get in their way. So, but they actually celebrated it and they turned it into the greatest mitzvah. That kind of, I would say, theologically is what set them apart. And then, of course, they put that into practice. And over the last, you know, 50 plus years, they've committed 60 plus racist murders. And that's officially, I have, you know, I can't get too much into some of the stories that I'm working on, but there's, you know, credible evidence that they actually murdered more than twice that number. In any case, 60 plus documented racist murders, mostly Palestinians, mostly in Palestine, over the last half century. So we're talking about certainly a fringe movement, the furthest right fringes of Israeli politics, but one that in many ways has been the vanguard, been the most, you know, has pulled the Israeli government inexorably further and further to the right, where now, you know, we have them actually back in the Knesset with the help of the prime minister. And as I argue in my most recent op-ed, as I said, this is the legacy of the longest running Israeli prime minister to mainstream the most murderous group in Jewish history, in modern Jewish history.
So, David, then how is it that if they're so fringe, how is it that they've, that we see a rise in their popularity, and how is it that they've become so ingrained in the Likud party?
It's a good question. How is it that, you know, Israelis, well, first of all, look, it's a documented fact, because Israelis are polled every few years and they're asked, you know, would you be willing to have a non-Jew live in the same building as you? Would you be willing to have a non-Jew study in the same school as your son or daughter? So, you know, people are asked these questions, the Israelis are polled, and they're getting more racist. That's the scary part, you know. In a lot of places in the world, the youth are less racist than their parents. But here we find it's in the opposite. The direction, the trajectory is in the opposite direction. Kids are even more racist than their parents, sadly. So what are the causes for it? The causes are many. And I would say that, look, it's going to be this way in any society. It's just that the Kahanists have, by hook or by crook, they've. Think of it this way: here's a way that we can measure their rise in influence. In the 1980s, when they, when a member of the Kahanists in Hebron, on the Jewish holiday of Purim, shot at a Palestinian car, the response of the Israeli Defense Minister was to actually raise, to destroy the settlement that Kahanist settler came from. That was in the 80s, okay? By the 90s, just a decade later, when another Kahanist immigrant from the U.S. also pulled out a rifle and shot Palestinians, and this time was successful in his attempt to murder. He murdered 29 Palestinians and wounded over 100 more in 1994. In that instance, the response wasn't to shut down the settlement that he came from, but rather to shut down the Palestinian marketplace of Hebron, to shut down the Palestinian community affected by that murder.
By the murder perpetrated by Baruch Goldstein.
Exactly. And now we're already in a position, you know, here we are in the 2020s, and the Israeli Defense Minister, Naftali Bennett, a few months ago, he actually ordered the restoration of the park named after Rabbi Kahana in Hebron, just outside Hebron. So now we have, and that very neighborhood that used to be the Palestinian, thriving Palestinian fruit market, will be, he announced, turned into a Jewish settlement for more, you know, extremist Jewish settlers to harass the local Palestinians, the largest Palestinian urban population in the southern West Bank.
You know, David, so in the past, we saw that the elections commissions they both banned Meir Kahana's party, Kach. Mm-hmm. And then we saw in the last election that at least some of the individuals who are offshoots of, or who are disciples, let's say, of Meir Kahana, that they were also banned. Why was the party banned? And was that the end of it? Did we see the end of Kahanism once the party was banned?
Mm-hmm. Okay, good question. So that's what was, you know, earlier I spoke about what was occurring on the ground. In the sense of what was occurring in the Knesset, you know, in the legal sense, in the political sense, you know, after Kahana got into the Knesset, the reaction was by many politicians revulsion, because his proposals were so explicitly racist. You know, he advocated ethnically cleansing the country of non-Jews, and, you know, who didn't agree to swear fealty to, you know, in submission to the Jewish people. So by definition, you know, like, he, at least from some liberal Zionists, I would say, you know, not too many, even on the ruling Likud party, you know, today, Benjamin Netanyahu's, you know, right-wing party, even many of their liberal, you know, many of the Likud lawmakers were disgusted. In fact, one of them, Dan Merido, led the efforts in the Knesset to have Kahana banned for racist incitement. You know, they changed the laws so that if someone makes explicitly racist statements, then they are prohibited from being candidates for Knesset. So, you know, that's the reason why he was banned in 1988. Some would say it was also to the advantage of the ruling Likud party by that point, you know, because in fact, polls showed that if he was allowed to be, if he would have been allowed rather to run in the following elections in 1988, that in fact he would have maybe received 10 seats or more in the Knesset, maybe 10% of the Knesset. In that case, he would have certainly been a minister. By the standards of those days, today you only need to have like a couple seats, a few seats to be a minister. But then you know, you would have had to have more, and he would have been one. But so Likud had a good reason to ban him. That's 88. What happened between then and now? Well, we just earlier heard about some of the attempts. You know, there were attempts to re-enter the Knesset using a different name, you know, and sure, you can't make explicitly racist statements, and but of course that requires some liberal, you know, journalist, activist, legislator, to researcher to go out and follow and, you know, catalog all the racist statements and then bring them. And, you know, in any case, it didn't come to that because they didn't have enough, you know, they didn't represent enough of a threat. They didn't have enough votes to pass the threshold that Israeli Knesset kept raising to prevent small parties like Kahana's from entering the Knesset. So all those years, they didn't have, if it was 30,000 votes or 50,000 votes or whatever. But now you need over 100,000 votes to get into the Knesset. And the Kahanists are, that's a lot of votes to get. Do they have 100,000? No. When they ran on their own a few years ago in their newly constituted Jewish Power Party, they did manage to get tens of thousands of votes, but not enough. So they had to combine with another Kahanist light party. I mean, is the leader of the Religious Zionism Party they bonded with Bezalel Smotrich any less of a Kahanist? He, you know, his famous plan is literally taken straight from Kahanism's playbook. It's three options. You know, non-Jews, the Palestinians have three options according to him: either leave the country or agree to be slaves to the Jews, you know, like swear fealty to them, as I said, or die by the sword. Those are the, you know, the same principle, three principles of Kahana. So what's the difference between, that's okay, you know, maybe, you know, put a bow tie on him, put some lipstick on him. It's just Kahanism light. And in any case, this new party with the Kahanists and the Kahanist lights, whatever you want to call them, they now, thanks to the blessing of Benjamin Netanyahu, who's been, you know, using his political capital to urge for this union in order to give the right-wing party enough seats in the Knesset so that he can remain in power and not be taken to jail for corruption crimes that he's been charged with. So because of the confluence of both rising racism that's been constant in Israeli society every year, plus the continuous determination of the Kahanists to get in there, and the addition of Benjamin Netanyahu, longest-serving prime minister in Israeli history, you know, being up to his neck in corruption crimes and, you know, pulling in every direction, willing to do anything, even to bring in the Judeo-fascists, even to bring in the most murderous, you know, Jewish faction in modern Jewish history, even then. So it's those three contributing factors that allowed the Kahanists this time to get into the Knesset. I know that's a mouthful, but...
But, you know, it's not just Smotrich, it's also Lieberman. Lieberman's mm-hmm. also espoused the same viewpoints of... of loyalty or leave, mm-hmm. So
true,
it's
true. That's a good point. There's so many, yeah. And Lieberman was a member of the Kach party back in the day. You know, but back in the day, you know, when Netanyahu brought him into the cabinet, at that point, you still had to be an ex-Kahanist to get into government. You know, same with Tzachi Hanegbi. He'd also been with, you know, with, yes, been with Kahana, and he also, you know, had to be an ex-Kahanist in order to get into Netanyahu's government in 1996. But yeah, you're right. There's so many, so many. We really have to count those.
So what do you expect that they will... What do you expect that they'll do now that they're going to be in the Knesset? Are they going to be pushing for certain types of legislation? And what should we be looking out for? What should we be concerned about?
Specifically, what to be, you know, where should our attentions be focused in order to anticipate their next moves? Well, okay, the leader of the Jewish Power Party, Itamar Ben-Gvir, is a licensed lawyer in Israel, and he apprenticed at the office of Baruch Ben Yosef, one of the suspected assassins of Alex Zawadeh. And since he got his legal license in 2012, he has, even beforehand, he was, you know, at the basically always fighting the Kahanist fight. You know, he basically took over Baruch Ben Yosef's caseload, always defending the most racist murderer, you know, Israelis who, you know, killed Palestinians. And so, you know, he took over the new caseload of the new Israeli terror, new Kahanist terrorists, new wave. But in addition to that, you know, always, you know, with legal challenges, you know, for example, you know, this is kind of an infamous case of Israeli law when an Israeli liberal Zionist journalist called Itamar Ben-Gvir and called him like a little Nazi. You know, he called Kahanists Nazis and Itamar Ben-Gvir a little Nazi. So this actually, you know, he sued him for libel. How dare you call me a Nazi? That's a grave thing to say. Well, it came to an Israeli court. In fact, it came to the Supreme Court. And what was decided in that case was, okay, yes, in fact, it is libelous to call Itamar Ben-Gvir and Kahanists Nazis. However, that same court, you know, punished said liberal Zionist journalist by fining him for that crime one shekel, which is equivalent to like an American quarter. So thereby essentially authorizing that, you know what, if it's not Zionism, if it's not Nazism, if Kahanism isn't Nazism, it's like a shade lighter and not more. And so the point is, Itamar Ben-Gvir has always been at the forefront of the legal struggle, you know, in the courts. And as such, he has a tremendous amount of experience. He knows very well judges all across the country. He's been in court so many times. He knows their judicial records, how they, you know, how they decide. And so as such, he has been tapped in recent years, even before he even got into the Knesset. You know, he was working with fellow genocide insider, Minister Ayelet Shaked, when she was justice minister, to kind of prepare lists of good judges and bad judges. So who she should be giving promotions to and who she shouldn't give promotions to, because they're suspected of, you know, ruling that, believing that Palestinians are human beings and therefore, you know, deserve rights. And so, they're suspect. Don't give them promotions or advancements. So yeah, even beforehand, he's had a really big influence in the legal sphere. It seems obvious that, you know, that's going to be one of the ways that he influences. They've long been calling for, you know, this rule that will neuter the Supreme Court so that it cannot be the final brakes on the excesses of the government, the legislature, to prevent the worst, you know, abuses of the rights of Palestinians and other non-Jews and other minorities. So, but yeah, it seems that that's going to be the direction that they're going to be focused on. But who can say? Who can say? It's all kind of up in the air now. But certainly these are the most racist and most murderous. The furthest right, we need to be watching them like hawks, because nothing good can come of them being in the Knesset.
Well, David Sheen, thank you very much. This has been illuminating, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
David, where can we see your writings and your work?
Really easy to get at me. Just one way, go to my website, davidsheen.com, and from there, there's links to everything. YouTube, Twitter, you know, lists of my most recent articles, and I got lots of videos out there that you don't want to miss. But davidsheen.com, and on Twitter, it's at David Sheen.
Thank you very much, David.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Omar Badar. This April 4th would have been the 77th birthday of Palestinian-American civil rights advocate Alex Zawadeh. He was murdered 36 years ago when his office at the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in California was bombed. The primary suspects belonged to the Jewish Defense League, an FBI-designated terrorist organization founded by Rabbi Meir Kahane, and whose members had been sending death threats to Odeh before the murder. Now, despite the primary suspects being known, they were never arrested or brought to justice. In this episode, we talked to investigative journalist David Sheen about how the suspects have avoided accountability. But first, we're joined by another previous guest of the podcast, Dr. James Zoghbi. He's president of the Arab American Institute and a friend of the late Alex Odeh. He's also one of the most prominent Democratic National Committee members over many decades and was the leading voice advocating for Palestinian rights within the party. From the 1988 Democratic National Convention, where he spoke from the podium in support of Palestinian rights, to the Executive Committee and Platform Drafting Committee in later years, where he introduced language opposing Israel's occupation. Jim, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Omar.
So Alex Odeh was murdered more than 35 years ago. Really shocking to think that he was murdered in California for simply being an Arab American who was advocating for Palestinian rights. And yet I think a lot of young people today barely recognize the name. Can you talk a little bit about who Alex was as a person and what we know about his murder case?
Well, I knew Alex going back to the very early 80s when we founded the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. I was the co-founder and executive director, and I hired Alex to run our Southern California office. It was kind of funny. The one little bit of tension I had with Alex was I kept calling it the Southern California office, and he kept saying, it's Orange County. Maybe I can do Los Angeles. But I'd say, I need you to go to San Diego. And he'd say, that's an all-day trip. You know, I had no idea about the distance. He said, in this part of the country, we measure distance by hours, not by miles. I looked at it on the map and it looked close, but it wasn't. Anyway, he was Orange County and Los Angeles. We did a couple of forays out to Bakersfield and Riverside together, but he did an extraordinary job. And what was so wonderful about Alex was his everyone liked him. He was kind. He was thoughtful. He was very quiet, and did his work in a very disciplined but respectful way. I mean, people who had differences of opinion with him, it never accelerated because of the fact that Alex was always able to bring tension down in a conversation between different factions, different personalities, et cetera. Mm-hmm. He was a good person. I worked with him for more than 3 years. We had some very funny episodes together where, you know, I got nervous or tense and Alex would sit there with this very calm look on his face and say to me, it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. It's going to be okay. I mean, that was his constant sense that it's going to be okay. In 1984, one of the last things I did while I was still at ADC was I went to see the director of the FBI, and I brought affidavits with me. There were over 100, about 110, from people in the Southern California area complaining about FBI harassment. And there was the time when they were going from place to place, interviewing Palestinian activists, interviewing their neighbors, interviewing their employers, their co-workers. And it was outright harassment. There were no problems of any sort that had occurred. At one point, there was this issue of the Los Angeles 8 that were 7 Palestinians and a Kenyan woman, the wife of one of them, who were arrested for selling Al Hadaf, the paper, the newspaper of the Palestinian, the PFLP. They were selling a newspaper, but there was a material support provision that was being implemented, and they got arrested for it. But that was it. And at the same time, I brought about a dozen affidavits from people in Southern California complaining about direct death threats or threats of violence. 3 of them came from Alex. I went to the director and I said, why do you spend so much time harassing people, so little time protecting their rights? And then a year later, Alex was murdered. The threats we knew came from the JDL. It was their modus operandi. And And, you know, it was interesting, after each of the incidents of violence that were tied to them, they didn't issue statements saying that they did it. They would issue statements saying that they approved of it. And that's what they did to me. That's what they did to Alex. And we lost a good person, a good soul, a wonderful man who, as I said, was beloved by everyone that worked with him.
Yeah. And Jim, there's a lot of frustration with the fact that post-murder, so before the murder, there was frustration with the fact that the authorities were not doing enough to protect Arab American activists and their rights. But even afterwards, there's frustration with the sense that this case was not taken seriously enough to really pursue the likely culprits. You know, we talk about the threats coming and having a sense of who the suspects are, and yet they were not really pursued. Can you talk just a little bit about that as well?
There was a real sense of frustration that the JADL was on the terrorist list, and the incidents that they were accused of committing were against mainly Jewish targets. A lot of it had to do with Soviet Jewry. There was an impresario and a promoter in New York who brought the Moscow Ballet, and they attacked his office. They murdered a woman. There were other firebombings that were tied to the JDL. Again, mostly against Jewish targets that disagreed with them. And the FBI would respond. When they firebombed my office, the FBI came and interviewed me. And I found out halfway into the conversation, I said, wait, you guys are asking me questions about Palestinians who I knew and you know, who might have a grudge against me. But that's not who issued a statement today saying that they approved of the bombing. It was the Jewish Defense League. We know who the culprits are. We have a good reason to suspect who the culprits are. Why aren't you doing anything? And they didn't. And it was the same with the Alex situation. They simply did not move. They spent more time prosecuting and holding in prison for a long period of time till they were finally acquitted. The Palestinians who were charged with selling a newspaper than they did with any of these JDL guys who were directly involved in acts of violence. I mean, I was in a demonstration in Philadelphia at one point, and the JDL came and started throwing bottles against the wall of the building that was behind us so that the glass would shatter down on us. One young woman lost her eye. The police harassed those of us who were demonstrating. The JDL walked off with nothing. That was very, very troubling. I mean, we were considered the problem. They were considered a nuisance. And so, yeah, after Alex was murdered, the culprit, we believe, the person we believe was the culprit, who now has been more or less identified by an Israeli journalist, is someone living on the West Bank, and living there for many, many years, has never been apprehended, and never a extradition request from Israel to send him back. It is deeply troubling that this case has never been resolved.
You know, we talk about the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel, and we think of it almost exclusively in terms of diplomatic protection and military aid, but it also extends to instances like these, which are extremely frustrating that there would not be an effort.
I remember at one point, we got this bizarre, convoluted answer from the FBI about why they couldn't do anything. And it had to do with the fact that they think that the person that we identified and that they had identified as the person of interest in the case was on a settlement in the West Bank. And they said there was a jurisdictional issue. They couldn't go to Israel because they didn't recognize Israel's control over the West Bank, and the PA had no authority in this. And it was like, come on, that was just a little bit too far-fetched for me to believe that they could claim Israel had no control over the settlement, and therefore they didn't want to acknowledge Israel's occupying role by requesting an extradition.
If the U.S. does not wield enough influence with its client states to get something like that taken care of. Jim, we talked earlier in the podcast about the JDL being founded by Rabbi Meir Kahane, and you also just mentioned that your office was firebombed by the JDL. And I know that your personal experience with them was not just a one-off. You've also received many threats from them, but I don't think many people know about your experience.
Yeah, the first one was 1971 on my wife's birthday. We had a envelope slid under our door, and I was, we thought it was a birthday greeting for her from somebody in the apartment building. Mm-hmm. She opened it, and it was weird because you see them on TV shows, but you never get one of those letters where the letters are all cut out of magazines and mm-hmm. taped on a piece of paper to read words. Yeah. And it was Arab dog, you will die if you set foot on campus again. Mm-hmm. At that point, I had not been active in Palestinian thought. I was very active in civil rights demonstrations and in anti-war demonstrations. And this one guy, Aaron, as I recall, Aaron Blumenthal was the name, was very tall, redheaded JDLer. I remember him shouting out, "Why are they letting the Arab guy speak?" And a whole big conversation ensued after this anti-war, they were setting the agenda for the anti-war rally as to whether or not it was appropriate that the Arab guy, that was supposed to be me,
just on account of being Arab,
could speak. Yeah. And and so, you know, I went to the campus police and they said, "Oh, it's kind of boys, you know, boys will be boys, nothing serious here." And the next day, you know, I was teaching class at Temple University, and a group of the JDLers gathered outside my office, chanting and taunting and saying that they were going to come in and get me. And I was saved by the fact that there was a group of Black women, Black students in the class, led by this one woman whose name I only remember was Sharon. She was tough, and she got a bunch of the guys together, and they marched out into the hall, and the JDL kids scattered. And every time they came back after that, these other kids offered me protection.
Yep.
But that went on for a couple months. And then, you know, I moved out to central Pennsylvania. Didn't have any problems when I was out there teaching at the college. But when I went to move to Washington and opened the Palestine Human Rights Campaign, the threat started again. And at one point, the office got firebombed. And like I said, the JDL issued a statement approving of it. And a few months later, I forget how many months later, the PHRC had ended, and I'd gone over to work at ADC. We co-founded it together, former Senator Abrisk and I. Mm-hmm. And I was in my office, and we got a press release slid under the door that Meir Kahan would be in the National Press Building. That's where our office was the next day, protesting us. Being there. And I was, you know, we called the police, and sure enough, you know, pounding on my door the next day was, "We know you're in there. We know where you are. We've come to find you." He said, "You got scared and after the firebombing and moved and changed the name of your group," which was his, I guess, his understanding of why I left Palestine Human Rights Campaign and came over to the Anti-Discrimination Committee.
Yep.
The police came, ushered him away. I went downstairs just to see what had happened, and he was holding an impromptu press conference downstairs. A Palestinian journalist, Hossein Bashara, stacked some pictures, which I still have in my office, of Kahan down there about, you know, Zogby and his pro-Palestinian and whatever. And it was pretty much the end of what I had heard from him. The murder of Alex came later, and then he moved to Israel, of course. Kahan moved to Israel. The JDL was banned here in the States. The JDL got banned in Israel, and the Kach movement was equally banned as a terrorist group in Israel, mm-hmm. because members of the group, followers of Kahan, one was implicated in the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, and another committed the murder in the Hebron the mosque in the Ibrahim Mosque in Hebron that was took the lives of 29 Palestinian worshipers. And Kahan himself got elected to Knesset, but he was declared after a period of time, somebody who would be expelled from the Knesset. Mm-hmm. And that I thought was the last we'd hear from them in terms of its above ground manifestation. But then they formed the group Jewish Power. Netanyahu courted them just a few years ago. They didn't get Knesset seats. He wanted their votes, though. And this time he did encourage them to coalesce with a group of religious Zionists, and they have now elected members in the Knesset. And if Netanyahu forms a government, he has promised them a ministerial position. And yet there's no reaction. I mean, even in Israel, there's a little bit of a ho-hum, and some people on the more liberal side complain. But the outrage of having people who are actual terrorists, I mean, people who are responsible for the murder of a prime minister, an act that killed worshipers in a mosque, commit violence frequently against the Palestinian villagers. The silence is shocking.
So just want to reiterate what you're saying right now. This was a group of violent, overt racists who were explicitly banned from Israeli politics many years ago, and we're today at a point where the head of the Jewish Power Party celebrates Baruch Goldstein as a hero, the man who killed 29 mm-hmm. innocent Palestinians in a mosque. And now this party is in the Knesset and likely part of the next Israeli government.
I mean, and the U.S., which, you know, rightly condemns other countries for having terrorists, groups that the U.S. calls terrorists in their government, they call this group terrorists. The U.S. calls this group terrorists. Mm-hmm. And yet I haven't heard a word from anybody in an official government role. And what I hear from AIPAC is, well, we won't have any dealings with them. That's not the issue. I don't care if you have dealings with them or not. I have an issue with you not speaking out about the fact that this has happened and you knew it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And you knew that the prime minister was courting them and promised them a position in government and said nothing about it.
Yeah. Jim, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks, Omar.
If you've listened to our last episode, then you've heard investigative journalist David Sheen's conversation with Diana Butu about the Kahanists. As an elaboration on that conversation, Sheen also talked to us about the suspected murderers of Alex Aude.
So just a few words about Alex Aude and the significance of his murder. I mean, he was a Palestinian man born in the West Bank, immigrates to the United States. There he becomes a spokesperson for the Arab American and Palestinian American communities, really just as they're starting to find their voice in the American political system. Up to that point, you know, the Zionist movements essentially didn't have any competition in D.C. for the ears of U.S. legislators. And at that point, in the early 80s, Arab Americans start speaking out, start calling out Israel's invasion of Lebanon, start asking, why are we sending, you know, billions of dollars to the Israeli military every year? That money could be spent here at home. And so, you know, this kind of discourse is seen as a threat by Zionist groups, not only to the Kahanists, but even mainstream Zionist groups like the Anti-Defamation League that actually spied on Alex Aude and had a map of his office and keys to his office. And in any case, of course, the Kahanists took it to the full out extent. They assassinated him, according to the FBI. And apparently they were following the alleged assassins and then lost them just before the murder. And that's why they arrived at the murder site, the bombing site, at Alex Aude's office just half an hour after it occurred, because they had been following the suspects from the East Coast, where they had already committed a bombing run and left a bloody trail behind them. So there was never any question about who had committed the attack. And so, okay, there's the issue of these men getting away with this murder, 36 years later. But then kind of what compounds the audacity of it all is that these men did not, you know, then live quiet lives and, you know, stay low and try not to attract attention to themselves or something. Just the opposite. I mean, they have continued to be front and center of the Kahanist movement and in efforts to, you know, to achieve the Kahanist objectives of turning Israel into an ethnically cleansed theocracy. So if you can imagine this, this is what's happened to the suspects of Alex Oda's murder. Okay, well, there's three. One of them is actually sitting in jail, but it's for another murder, nothing to do with this. But he was indicted for that other murder. His name is Robert Manning. He's sitting in a U.S. jail, serving a life sentence for that other murder. But the other two suspects of Alex Oda's assassination have been, you know, living free in Israel and occupied territories and raising their families and living large ever since. So how'd they do it? So, you know, they were, you know, full-on terrorists in the 1980s, but in the 1990s, they shifted tack. And what happened was Emmanuel Rachman, he was the provost of Yeshiva University, but also a top fundraiser for Kahana, would raise funds in the U.S., where he has deep roots from where he emerged, and he'd send this money that he'd raised to Kahana. And eventually, Emmanuel Rachman actually moves to Israel, becomes the head of Bar Ilan University Law School. With him there at the head, the law school essentially becomes a hothouse for the Israeli far right. The most famous student to emerge from that law school in the early 1990s was Yigal Amir. Yigal Amir, inspired by the Kahanist massacre in 1994 of 29 men and boys in the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron, Halil. Inspired by that, Yigal Amir goes and assassinates Israel's prime minister, Yitzhak Rabin, for having the for signing a peace deal, the Oslo Accords, with the PLO. So for this, he assassinates Prime Minister Rabin.
And it's worth noting that the Oslo Accords didn't even come close to giving Palestinians true self-determination. It gave them extremely limited autonomy under Israeli occupation. And yet this was still deemed a crime worthy of murder for the Kahanists.
And who would then go on to defend law student Yigal Amir in court? His fellow, his cohorts from Bar Ilan Law School, who themselves are Kahanist terrorists. In the past, we have, on one hand, we have Craig Leitner, who is an American-born Kahanist who moved to Israel and was sat in jail for attacking Palestinians near Ramallah. And then on the other hand, we have Baruch Ben Yosef, who we've just discussed, Kahanist terrorist from America, who, you know, terrorized Palestinians in the Hebron area and then went back and, according to the FBI, assassinated Alex Oda. So these Kahanist terrorists then serve as their fellow Bar Ilan Law School students' legal defense in defending him from these charges, these murder charges of murdering the prime minister. And these two ex-Kahanist terrorists turned lawyers then are part, you know, they realize that, you know, they need to continue on the legal front, the Kahanist fight. And the way that they do that is by founding and being the emergent leaders of Israel's Zionist lawfare movement. And now I have to take a quick breath and explain what that means, even the lawfare movement. Again, it's trying to achieve the same objectives, but in the court, trying to penalize Palestinians and win victories against them in the legal arena. And so what this would look like was, you know, these groups, and I'll name them. In Israel, you know, Craig Leitner and his wife established Shurat HaDin. That's the top Israeli lawfare group. And in the U.S., the Kahanists established the American Center for Civil Justice, the ACCJ. And they were the top American lawfare group. And so these two groups, what they would do is they would, on behalf of victims of terror attacks, they would sue governments that had funded terrorists in the past. So let's say they would sue Libya or they would sue North Korea on behalf of, you know, victims of terror attacks in the 80s and 90s and such, and then win massive amounts. And when I say massive amounts, we're talking about like hundreds of millions of dollars or over $1 billion in payouts from these governments. And then with these massive funds, you know, their whole philosophy is, you know, we need to stop terrorism, and the way to stop terrorism is by stopping funding to terrorism, is by penalizing the terrorist funders. We are thereby reducing terrorism. So they claim that the whole purpose of their lawfare organization is to punish terrorism, you know, to punish them in their purse. But then what did they do with these monies that they made? They just funded it to their employees who themselves were terrorists, you know. So the money supposedly geared to stop terrorism then is used to fund terrorism. Craig Leitner and Baruch Ben Yosef and Israel Fuchs, so the two alleged assassins of Alex Aude, are on the payroll of the American Center for Civil Justice. And Israel Fuchs is like their top, he's the head of their Israel office. And so on one hand, you know, it's you know, perverting the whole idea of essentially fighting terrorism by actually funding terrorism. You know, it's incredible that they had the chutzpah to do this and that they get away with it. But, you know, in addition, there's also, you know, what they, you know, the effect that they've had on the Israeli political scene, you know, in the courts. Baruch Ben Yosef, you know, graduates from Bar Ilan University, and he goes on to defend other Kahanist killers, to represent them in court, and he's been in Israel's Supreme Court dozens of times, defending himself and other Kahanists. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, in recent years, he's passed on much of his caseload to his protege, Itamar Ben-Gvir, now the leader of the Jewish Power Party and member of Knesset. But there's also, you know, his, you know, fellow accused assassin of Alex Aude, Israel Fuchs. He, in addition to, you know, being on the payroll of the ACCJ, he's also established, with other Kahanists, he founded in Israel an NGO by the name of Meshilut, the Movement for Governance and Democracy. Sounds so positive, like they're only trying to improve things in the country. And of course, what they've done is that they've authored legislation that is geared towards weakening the civil court system. The whole point is to hollow it out so that it is completely toothless, so it's been completely neutered, so that it has no power, so that it can't be the last line of defense for minorities. And so this, by weakening the judiciary, the Kahanists hope, it would allow the government and the legislature to run roughshod over the rights of non-Jews and to pass any racist legislation, and for there to be no pushback from the judiciary. And those men writing this legislation, the Kahanist founded organization, you know, their top lawyer, Simcha Rotman, is now also a member of Knesset. The Kahanists also, you know, had him on their slate and put him into parliament. So, I mean, it's insane to imagine this, but, you know, Kahanist terrorists have managed to live on the high hog with money ostensibly, you know, facilitated by the U.S. government. I mean, the U.S. government oversaw this transfer of money from other countries to lawfare groups like the ACCJ, you know, which then paid out Baruch Ben Yosef and Israel Fuchs, who are, you know, known suspected terrorists. So in addition to that, they're actually attending Knesset meetings and changing Israeli law, and are now have a front seat in those committees to completely eviscerate the judiciary and, in their minds, eventually replace it with a theocratic judicial system in which Israel's laws are strictly based on the Torah and the Talmud, and of course the most extreme interpretations of them. It's insane to imagine that these accused killers have gone on to achieve such political power, but that's where we are today.
So if these suspected terrorists who likely killed an American citizen in Alex Aude are known, why doesn't the U.S. government go after them?
Good question. The answer to this is, why haven't these people, the question of why haven't they ever been arrested? There's lots of reasons for it. The Israeli government didn't help much. The Israeli, Israel's version of the FBI, the Shin Bet, they didn't help out their American counterparts when they should have. They didn't provide the intelligence that could have helped close the case earlier. I mean, that's to be expected, sadly. There's other reasons, and we can point the finger in different directions, but the bottom line, you know, after researching this case high and low for the last 2 years, I know it better than pretty much anyone else. And I can say with 100% certainty, though I'm not a lawyer myself, I can't claim to be a legal expert, I have seen more, you know, after interviewing many FBI agents that have worked on the case then and now, I can say, you know, with complete certainty that the FBI now has enough evidence to conclusively, you know, close the case, to indict these men, to, you know, demand their extradition, to put them on trial, and to convict them and to jail them for the murder of Alex Sode. Why don't they? At this point, in my opinion, it's just about pressure. It's just about pressure. Admittedly, the FBI has its hands full right now. It's kind of dealing with its, with, you know, American effort, a local effort to take over the U.S. government by a far-right group. And obviously, I'm talking about the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. And so that case is, you know, obviously sucking up a lot of the FBI's resources at present. Alex Sode, we're talking about a 36-year-old cold case. And, you know, obviously, in order to get the U.S. government, to get law enforcement to bump up its importance and to devote resources to it and to follow through, because it would take a lot of effort, obviously, for political reasons and just logistically to put together these indictments, there needs to be pressure. That's the bottom line. There needs to be pressure from Palestinian solidarity community and other lovers of justice and equality and freedom who, you know, are disgusted by what I've described thus far and would, you know, actively lobby the U.S. government and the U.S. law enforcement to close the case.
And to close the case here just means to do their job and solve a terrorist attack that killed an American. Do you think activists can generate the needed pressure to get this done?
You know, it's hard to say because I don't need to explain to you, sadly, you know, Palestinians are fighting on so many fronts. It seems like, you know, with the recovering from 4 years of Trump and the rise of Kahanism, and, you know, there's Palestinians who are suffering in every direction and being dispossessed on all sides. It, you know, daily, it's hard to imagine efforts being invested towards seeking justice in a 36-year-old cold case. But that's what has to happen, seemingly, in order to put this over the top and to convince the U.S. government that enough people want justice done to get their butts in gear. Yeah, that's what's going to take. I don't know if we're going to see that, but the roadmap is there. And listeners of this podcast, if you want to see justice done, you know what to do.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org. I'm Deanna Butu. Thanks for listening. So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google? For more information, contact us at kumbit.org or email at info@kumbit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.